Hi, this is Aspen Grinder. I'm here with Peter Sarna in Kansas City, Kansas. I'll read this brief statement and then we'll start with some questions. The Department of Religious Studies at the University of Kansas is conducting a research project that seeks to preserve the history of various churches and other religious organizations in Kansas. We would like to record your experiences in religious organizations. We expect that each interview will take about 30 minutes to an hour, usually. We assure you that you are not obligated to participate and may discontinue your involvement at any time. Since we are trying to create a public record of Kansas religious history, we are primarily interested in interviewing persons who agree to let their interviews be available to the general public through a website and to be identified by name as the person who was interviewed. Should you have any questions about the project, please contact Professor Tim Miller. And if you don't have his contact information, I can get that to you. And if you have any questions about your rights as a research participant, you may call the Human Subject Protection Office, and I can give you that information as well if you'd like. But does that sound fine?
Yes.
All right. Well, Pastor Sarna, could you tell me a bit about just where you're from and where you grew up?
I grew up in Toronto, Canada, and my parents are from Estonia, the former Soviet Republic of Estonia. And they left Estonia due to the communist advance. There, my father is actually being in armies of four different countries. He's also been in a labor camp in Kazakhstan, sent there by the Russians. So he's been in the Estonian army, forced into the Russian army, surrendered to the Germans on the front line, put into a German prisoner of war camp, and then forced into the German army. And then he and Germany had moved into Estonia at the time, so he was in a prisoner of war camp in Estonia, German prisoner of war camp, and then in the German army in Estonia, and then before he was put out to fight or anything, he managed to desert the German army. So the fact that he had been in the Russian army and now was in the German army, he's already a deserter from the Russian army. Now he's a double deserter at this point. He lived out in the forest and they stole a boat. And went to Finland. He was trying to get to Sweden, but he ended up in Finland, and then he was forced to join the Finnish Navy. So he's been in the Estonian, Russian, German, and Finnish militaries, and then he finally made his way to Sweden and then to Canada, where he met my mom. My mom also escaped from Estonia and made it to Germany, believe it or not, where she worked in prisoner of war camps and stuff like this, and somehow she was a nurse and she was put to do this kind of stuff. And after the war, she went to England and made it to Canada. My parents met in Canada. And we grew up in an Estonian community in Canada, meaning that I went to Estonian Boy Scouts, played in Estonian rock bands, and had Estonian friends. And whenever we visited people, we visited Estonians, even though we lived in Canada. And I went to Estonian school once a week, where we learned about the culture and the language and this and that. So this is my upbringing. When I was 19, I was a wild teenager. So I didn't grow up really in a religious family. My parents were not religious, you know, and they kind of liked to drink. I do have some quite successful people in my relatives. One of my relatives, Adu Lucas, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, he managed to get the oil. The Russian oil was being sent by train to Estonia into storage tanks and then put onto those big tanker ships, and he got control of this whole thing with the collapse of the Soviet Union and during privatization, and he died with $850 million. So I didn't get any of it, by the way. So I got, and then I've got a guy who my cousin's son who was sent here one summer maybe 20 years ago for us to take care of him and show him about America and all this. And now he's a professor of economics at the Tallinn Technological University. And then I've got another guy right here. He's my second cousin in Toronto, Jan Cruz. And he was the head of UN He was a president of a UN organization called the World Meteorological Organization, not quite as prominent as UNICEF or anything, or WHO or anything, but that's my second cousin right there, and that's me here. So I've got some prominent relatives, but not religious relatives. You know, I'm the kind of guy, I guess, in my family and among my relatives who are pioneering religion, in a sense. And by the way, Estonians are the third least religious people in the world.
Oh, yeah?
North Koreans are first, Czech are second, and Estonians are the third.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of interesting.
The culture.
Yeah, I don't know why. It's kind of interesting. They're just not that religious, generally. Not that there's no religious people, but just on an average, somehow somebody's figured out that they're the third least religious people. When I was growing up, I actually won an award for best attendance at the confirmation, pre-confirmation. But everybody laughed when I got the award because I was a real naughty kid in the class and making paper airplanes out of the leaflets and throwing them around and then it just causing trouble. But I won the award and everyone was laughing that I won this award for best attendance. You know? So I was really not religious and I was kind of scared of religious people, those Jehovah's Witnesses. And then there's some Estonians in Toronto who are Baptists. You know, we were Lutherans, so the Lutherans are quite liberal, and they're not.
Right.
They might go to confirmation, but we all know what they're really up to. You know, they're partying and drinking, and they have, you know, and all that stuff, you know. But the Baptists, they were the more religious, serious religious people. And I knew one Baptist girl, and I kind of respected her because I knew she was much more serious about religious things than I was. I think my dad, with his background, he was very stern, very strong character, and difficult to get along with, you know. So because of that, I don't know what you call it, a typical troublemaking teenager. Mm-hmm. I started drinking when I was 15 and smoking pot and stuff and started having girlfriends and stuff like this. But by the time I hit 18, I went to college to study music, Humber College in Toronto, Canada. But somehow I felt something was really missing in my life. So I did all my stuff early in a way, right? So at this point of my life, I was really struggling, actually, when I was 18, about what's my life. I've got girlfriends, I've got my own apartment, I got beer in the fridge, and I can smoke marijuana when I want to, but I felt empty. And it's interesting to me that there's people who do that their whole life, and they never feel empty, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know,
they don't think what's next. Yeah.
But me, I was feeling empty. I felt that I'm not happy. I'm actually not happy. I felt there's something's, and I started. And my roommate actually, he was interested in meditation and this more Eastern type of stuff, you know, so we went to meet his. We went to Ottawa, my roommate in college. His parents had rented from my parents. They're also Estonians.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents owned this small apartment building. They rented. So we grew up with this guy. And then we're in college together, too. So we were roommates there. And he got into his godfather was a professor of architecture in Ottawa at the university there in Ottawa, Canada. And so we went to visit him, and we thought he was a really cool guy. So somehow I got involved in this meditation and health foods and this kind of Eastern-y kind of thing. And then I got involved in the Hari Das group, which is, Ram Das and Hari Das. Have you heard of these people?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I went out to California back in 1977, December 77, to meet this Hari Das guy and go to this big retreat with Hari Das and everything. And then I But I was thinking, I don't know, this is... They're talking about thousands of reincarnations. And, you know, and I was thinking, wait a second. Hey, you know, I'm a North American. I want my stuff now. I don't want to go through thousands of reincarnations, you know. I want my enlightenment now. And that was... I had written that on my wall on a piece of paper, enlightenment. And I want it now. Right? That's the American way. Well, I want my stuff now.
Impatience, yeah.
I don't want to go through thousands of reincarnations. So the funny thing is, I was down at this thing, at this, and this was in Santa Cruz, which is apparently quite an expensive city now, I find out. But we were in Santa Cruz, California, in December of 77. And then one of the people from Toronto, the Hari Dust group, says, hey, the Toronto Hari Dust people who were there in Santa Cruz for this big thing, says, hey, why don't you go to San Francisco for a day? You can take the bus for $5. Okay, what the heck? San Francisco, might as well go see it. And then, but I was walking around all over San Francisco and up and down. It was a rainy day, and I wasn't really that excited about it. It was January 2nd, 1978. When I was there, and that's when I met what we call my spiritual parent, the person who introduces you to the Unification Church. We call it the spiritual parent. Mm-hmm. So he and they had a very active witnessing program in the Bay Area at that time, where they had their full-time missionaries running all over the town and looking for young people. In those days, young people were quite open to this kind of stuff. These days, they're much less open to it seems like, in America. So anyway, so he said, hey, are you interested in spiritual things? And I says, yeah. And he says, well, why don't you come to my house? My sister, who wasn't really his physical sister, but he said, my sister's giving a talk at my house. Why don't you come? I was at the bus station at the time. And I said, okay. So I jumped in. And I went over, and it was, you know, there was a real spiritual atmosphere, very lively, and I thought, this is pretty cool. And they said they had this farm, and they're inviting people to the farm, and you could leave tonight. So I did, and I went up to the farm. But I thought I was just going to hang out with a bunch of cool people. But in fact, there was a lot of people there, and it was very organized. They had a lot of lectures, and you know, one after the other, and it wasn't just hanging out. You're listening to lectures, you know. So I was I was kind of into this being cool and stuff, and I didn't necessarily want to hear a bunch of lectures, but you know, and I was falling asleep during the lectures and stuff, and they'd keep trying to nudge me awake and stuff and stuff. But anyway, somehow I started thinking that, you know, after a few days there of those lectures, that maybe this is what God wants me to do, you know. Because I was having thoughts of some kind of ideal community, because I wanted to live in some kind of a spiritual community at this point in my life. I'd already was thinking in those ways, you know. So I thought, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the one, you know. So I kind of stuck with it and kept going to the... stayed with the seminars. I just went to one seminar after another for several weeks, and then I moved in with the missionary group there in, they sent me to Berkeley, which is, you know, part of the Bay Area thing, and I lived in they have a big center in Berkeley, and I lived there, worked with the church. We fundraised and did witnessing. We had a little business where we cleaned carpets, like an official business, you know, and I did that and stuff like that. So this is how I got involved with the Unification Church, and I was kind of prepared, you could say, in September, I was sent to Georgia and then New York City for fundraising efforts, and then I was put into I was asked to join a jewelry company we have called Christian Bernard Jewelry, which it may not be in America anymore, but it was originally from France, and it's sort of associated with our church. Mm-hmm. Our church members were all working together and living together. That group had their own big house and all worked together for that jewelry company called Christianburg and our jewelry. Anyway, so after that, I was asked to, in February 7, I think that was in 1979, I was asked to join a rock band of our church. Mm-hmm. And it turned out February 7, coincidentally, happened to be the day the Beatles had come to America. So we thought, oh, this is really providential from God, you know.
Meant to be, yeah.
Yeah, meant to be, you know. And even the leader of our band had John Lennon's birthday. And they split the band at that point. And the other guy in the other band had Paul McCartney's birthday, one of mm-hmm. the guys in the other band. So we thought, this is really...
It's all aligned, yeah.
It's all lining up, you know. So we did stuff. We were, I guess, the premier rock band of our church, you know. But we did... We owned the New Yorker Hotel, which was the World Mission headquarters at the time. And then there was a large coffee house there where we played every Friday called the Down Home Inn, and we had like 250 people would come and hear us. And, mm-hmm. and Reverend Mann gave us a bunch of money to buy equipment, so we had a really good PA system and all kinds of keyboards, and like a proper band mm-hmm. would be not like this little thing here, but like with microphones. Like I played the drums, and every drum had a microphone on it, like a concert situation even the guitar amps all had microphones, and we had monitors in the front mm-hmm. and a big PA and a big board and, you know, the whole thing, some lighting and all that stuff. So we did that, and I did the different missions in the church. Like that would be considered a mission. I'm a full-time mm-hmm. living in the church, and I'm not mm-hmm. actually getting any money. Mm-hmm. So we have actually the tax status of monks and nuns, because we're not dating. You know, we're not getting paid. Mm-hmm. So we're doing a church mission. So while you're a single person doing that, you have the tax status of monks, like the same as monks and nuns would have, you know. So I did that rock band thing. We're religious people, so mm-hmm. so it looks like rock band, you know, but actually we're religious people doing rock band, you know. Mm-hmm. So and we would also fundraise, and that's always a part of our church activity, fundraising and going out and trying to meet people, and so it's it's always trying to get the message out, you know, get Reverend Moon's message out. Eventually I was sent to, I was in Detroit after the rock band thing. I was in Detroit for 6 or 7 months back in 82. And then in 83, I joined a different band. Mm-hmm. And we traveled around America for a year, and I ended up in Utah for about a year. Mm-hmm. That would have been 84. In the end of 84, I came to Kansas. Yeah. So, and I, 84 to 98, I was, the end of 84 to 98, I was in Kansas, and then I went to Japan for 2 years and Burma for 5 years. Now, we have a mm-hmm. couple organizations in Burma. We have a couple of organizations. Women's Federation for World Peace, mm-hmm. WFWP, it has UN status. Mm-hmm. And UPF, Universal Peace Federation, that has UN status as well. So we did those two things in Burma. Mm-hmm. And so, like a country like Burma, it's a Buddhist country, and when you get your visas, it specifically says you are now not allowed to proselytize and this and that. So we have to be very careful about proselytizing in Burma. But you can, they do accept you doing this other work, you know. So we built schools. My wife was the president of WFWP Burma, Women's Federation for World Peace. We built some schools and did water and sanitation works where you build water tanks and you collect rainwater and then you send it up to the water tank and that provides water for people to wash their hands and do all this kind of thing. It's done through a rainwater collection, but you have to build the tanks and build the systems and all this stuff. Of course, we don't actually build the systems. We get engineers and people. We get the money and organize those kinds of things. So my wife did that kind of stuff. Not that she knows anything about engineering or building, but she would, get the money together and get the people to do that kind of thing. And we sponsored kids to go to school. At one point, we had about 300 kids we were sponsoring. So they'd get, I don't know what they were getting. They weren't getting a whole lot, but I think they're getting $50 or $60 a year. Mm. But for them, that was a little bit of money to help with uniforms and books and different things that they need to go to school. So let me see. So we came back 11 years ago. In 2005, we came back and ended up in Kansas City. And I became the pastor. I'd been the pastor before in Kansas, and I became the pastor when I stepped off the plane because the pastor had just quit. Not exactly quit, but gone to Seattle. So I just fit right back in here. So I became the pastor here in Kansas City. And I've been doing that ever since.
Were you a pastor in Topeka?
I was for 11 years, so till 98, so 87 to 98, I was a pastor in Topeka, now we don't have a building in Topeka, and we've sort of consolidated here in Kansas City, and it's moved. Our church has moved more from a single missionary church, which at one time almost everybody in the Unification Church in America were single missionaries. Mm-hmm. People started, we have these big marriages, these arranged marriages, so most people now are married and the kids are born into the church,
Right.
And of course that doesn't mean that they remain with the church. We do have kids who don't remain with the church for whatever reason, because they're born with it. We made our decision to join the church. This is something special and important to me, and I'm joining the Unification Church because I've been through this other stuff, and I think this is important for me. But our kids don't always see it that way. They grew up with the church and they like the church, and then suddenly they're in college and all the temptations come, and they don't see why they should stay pure or why they can't drink so we do have some a certain percentage of kids who do not stick with it, it's unfortunate from our viewpoint, but that does happen. So what is the origins of the church in America? Reverend Moon always had this vision to make a worldwide mission. So Reverend Moon, he received revelations since he was 15 years old. He was born in 1920, so from 1935 to 1945, and I hope I got my dates correct. Well, because the Korean counting is a little funky, They'll call you 16 when you're actually 15, so sometimes there's some confusion. But anyway, according to my understanding, there's a 10-year period where he received a lot of revelations. He did a lot of prayer and received a lot of revelations, and then he formalized it into our teaching, the Divine Principle, which was all based on Christian questions, typical Christian stuff. And that Divine Principle is, although people might say, well, this isn't Christian because you don't believe this and that, but it's all goes through the whole Bible, So anyway, he felt a calling to go to back. He was born in North Korea, and he felt a calling to go back to North Korea. I think that was in 1945. Mm-hmm. And then in about 1948, he was put into a communist labor camp. 1948, those death camps, basically. Mm-hmm. They're designed to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
They're not designed to really even re-educate you. They're designed to kill you. So, but he survived the camp. The UN came and bombed, and somehow in the middle of the bombing, he was able to escape in 1951, and he made his way down to Busan, which was, I think, the only point left that was not under communist control at that time, in the southern tip of South mm-hmm. Korea. And there he built his first church, you know, out of rocks and mud and bricks and whatever he could find, sticks and cardboard boxes, and it was the first church was maybe the size of this room, you know, and this is how he started. So, but he had this vision of building this worldwide movement the whole time. So that's and people thought he was just crazy. That, you know, this crazy guy's talking. He's just got this little hut over there. But he actually did it, you know. He built this worldwide movement, you know. So we have some activity in pretty much every country of the world. That doesn't mean we have a church in every country of the world, but something going on with the UN NGOs or some underground missionaries or something going on. And even one guy I know was in Afghanistan for a while, and, you know, in these very difficult places. And even Burma is a bit difficult too, you know. And we have even some activities in North Korea and all these, but they're not necessarily a typical church, you know, maybe some other kind of social activities or something going on, you know. Mm-hmm. So he was able to do that. Now, in America, he sent the first missionaries in 1959 to America, but these people were super powerhouses, you know. Mm-hmm. So these are kind of people like, ooh, you know, how did they do that? So they sent one theological professor, Young Eun Kim, to America, and she was very theologically orientated, not like myself, sorry, and they kept sending missionaries, and these people built up the church, you know, and there was a Oni Durst was a big, very powerful person. She's actually Korean, and I don't know her maiden name, but she married a professor, our church, a church member, mm-hmm. Dr. Moshe Durst, who's originally Jewish, and she became a real powerhouse in California. She sort of built the California Unification Church, when there was nobody there, and the California church became a very powerful church. And to the point where even our detractors made movies about it. There's a movie, have you ever heard of, called Ticket to Heaven? And it's a negative movie.
I don't think I have.
About our church. It's a Hollywood movie that went into cinemas, but it's a like a slam on the Unification Church.
Mm-hmm.
And they made everything look like bizarre, like people praying looked like they're possessed, and everything mm-hmm. looked like people are just totally possessed. But I was so fascinated by this movie because this is a Hollywood movie, and I watched
that one too. Whoa. Ticket to Heaven.
Yeah, and then I watched it 3 times until I finally realized, well, this is a really negative movie.
Right.
But I was so fascinated by it because the people who are featured in the movie are people I lived with in a Hollywood movie. Mm-hmm. Are people I live with. They're featured.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a Christina, you know, in this movie, and she's like, okay, heavenly children, we're going to do the pledge, and they made her look like totally evil or something, you know.
Yeah.
And we had the Dr. Durst, who'd give these lectures, but on the movie he was called Dr. Drone, because he's just droning on and on, you know. But that was fascinating to me, because these are people that I lived with. So That's to me, that's like, wow, we're kind of famous in an evil kind of way, you can say. You know,
notorious,
yeah. You know. But, so I thought that was kind of interesting, you know. So, anyway, that's you know, the church just seemed to grow, I guess, from that 1959, and, you know, we're in all the different, some kind of presence in every state. Our church here is only has about 50 members, and has, you know, it's very, I would say it's really rather quiet compared to maybe Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. or Chicago or some of these places where they have much larger groups of people. And it's become a much more of a Sunday service orientated thing, you know. And we don't have as many people joining in the way where we people would join and become full-time missionaries right away and go running around. We don't seem to have that kind of presence in the United States right now, except for our second generation, like my son. They do kind of running around and living in vans kind of and fundraising and all this kind of thing, you know. So, anyway, it's sort of expanded to what it has. We own the Washington Times newspaper. We bought controlling interest in the University of Bridgeport in Connecticut. And we own the New Yorker Hotel, which used to be the World Mission Center, is now being turned mostly into a hotel. And I don't know, they're using, I'm not sure who, they were the Ramada Inn at one point, but now they're, I think they're using a different hotel name. You know, you can use the name of a particular, you know, hotel, and you pay them, you know, to use their name, but you can make the money. So it's a big money maker for us, the New Yorker Hotel right now, to help run our headquarters, you know. And also we own the Manhattan Center, which is a recording studio. It's a professional recording studio, and many professional people record there, even though they're not religious. And there's been all kinds of people who have gone through the Manhattan Center who are not religious at all, such as Madonna and David Bowie and all these rap people and all kinds of people. But the, and, you know, and but it's to make money. You know, it's a business.
Sure.
And to help run our you know, our church. It's kind of odd that you do that, I guess, in a way, but that's one of the things that helps run our church in America. So, anyway, Reverend Moon, the principles of Unification Church are contained in the Divine Principle, and the Divine Principle is the, he talks about the principles of creation, the original ideal. We believe God had an original ideal for this world, but it has not come about because of the fall of man. This is, I guess, traditional Christian thinking, perhaps. And so we have our own explanation of the fall of man. And you know, to just get right to the point, we believe it was a sexual sin, not eating an apple. So they did not perfect themselves in the love of God, and they started having a sexual relationship before they were without God's blessing, basically. Not that sexual relationship is meant to be wrong or something. God gave it to us. We wouldn't be human beings if there weren't sexual relationship. But it was, but the origin of the sexual relationship, the first sexual relationships, was not really centered on God, and we believe that's the fall of man. And now the history of religion is being to rectify that. So that's why we believe in the family. You know, that's really important for us to try to have ideal families. You know. So and that's why the marriage is, you know, we try to promote the marriage and try to promote families and that kind of thing. You know, so. And then even the word evangelism is trying to expose the sin of Eve and the angel. So people are wondering, well, what's wrong with, well, why can't I just go to bed with whoever I want to, you know? Mm-hmm. I like this girl, and I like that, you know. But we're trying to say, well, if you really want to find God, you can't do that. You know, you can't go running around with whoever you want to and jumping into bed with different partners every week, you know. We don't believe that we can really find purity with God in that way, you know. So you may be tempted or you may be attracted to you know, and but we have to overcome those things, you know. So this is one of the keys of the Unification Church. Also, our view of the Messiah is different. We don't believe Jesus came to die. So that's a huge thing for Christians to oppose the Unification Church. We believe that Jesus' original mission was to build the kingdom of heaven. But, hey, people just couldn't deal with the guy, you know. They couldn't deal with this Jesus guy. He's just too much.
Troublemaker.
He's a troublemaker. He's too much. So they put him on the cross, you know. And so it was, and there's various reasons for that. And one of the, and here's the one that Baptists don't like, maybe, perhaps, is we believe John the Baptist was the one who really couldn't understand Jesus' mission. He's a key person who could have brought Jesus into acceptance in Israel at the time. But he really never really followed Jesus. He never became his disciple. He was doubting Jesus. Are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? He's doubting Jesus the whole time. His cousin, or, you know, I don't know about this guy. I don't know. He's just this guy, and you know, he just couldn't really support Jesus the way in our teaching. He did not support Jesus the way he was supposed to. He was the key person who could have changed history.
Mm-hmm.
So this is also a point of contention, I think, with perhaps other churches. I guess the real crux of what might be bothering a lot of people about the Unification Church is we actually believe that Reverend Moon comes in the position of the Messiah as the second coming. We don't believe Jesus is coming again in the flesh or something. We believe the mission is being passed on, you know. And we believe Reverend Moon has inherited that mission, we believe. This is our belief. So we have a different concept of the Messiah that perhaps Christians might have, where he's coming in the clouds or Jesus is coming again or something like this, you know.
Mm.
So our view is that Reverend Moon has inherited that mission. But, unfortunately, it doesn't happen beautifully and cleanly and nicely as we would like it to, in our view. And my, also me, being in the Unification Church for almost 39 years, I also thought, we're going to make that ideal world in just a couple of years or something, you know. And then after you start realizing, wait a second, this is taking a lot of time, you know. So, but that is really the ultimate goal of the Unification Church, would be to help build the ideal world. But I don't think even we can do it ourselves. We need the cooperation of all the religions of the world, you know. But that's hard, because every religion has their own concepts, you know, their own ideals and concepts. And we're just this little, the new kid on the block. Who are you to tell us about what's right and wrong, you know? We got this little Unification Church with just a few 100,000 people around the world, and we're trying to compete with Catholics who got over 1 billion people, and then the rest, and all of Christianity's got 2 billion people, and the Muslims got, you know, whatever it is, 1.5 billion or whatever their numbers are, and so we got this little group trying to compete with these powerful established groups. So I'm thinking, and it may take a while for us to gain the respect of, I mean, it's happening, you know, but slowly, you know, not quickly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
We're slowly gaining people's respect, you know.
Mm-hmm. How do you think that perceptions of the Unification Church have changed since you...
Well, because people used to, if you said you're with the Unification Church, one guy started shaking.
Yeah, I think I came across an interview that you had did, I think while you were still in Topeka, where you said that same thing that you would get.
Oh, you saw that interview?
I think so, yeah.
Tim showed you that?
No, I think I just came across it by doing an online search.
Really? The one guy was actually shaking when I said it. They were, and then we used to have people protesting in front of the churches here and there in California and New York with signs and things like that. And if we would go and tell people, like, we would try to, we have this thing called ACLC, American Christian Leadership Conference, and we would try to meet Christian leaders, and they would tell us we're brainwashed, and you know, we got a lot of that. We're brainwashed. They don't want to deal with it. So the easiest way not to deal with the Unification Church is you are brainwashed. Kind of, you know, they just stick that label on you. You don't know anything. And, you know, my parents would say that. And, you know, and never people would just, they just don't want to deal with it. You know, they just don't want to have, so I think now people are just more open. Toward that. You know, my neighbor is the city planner of Wyandotte County, and he's a Christian, but we have a good relationship with him. Whereas perhaps 20 years ago, he might have tried to find a way to get us thrown out of the neighborhood, you know, or 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, you know. And there's been churches that have had to close down because they had so much opposition, you know, that they actually had to sell their buildings, you know. And they would find some way. They would find some way, obscure law somewhere where they could, were not able to operate. Like, we bought a seminary one time, and this is a building where Aerosmith had practiced in that one time, you know. And that was okay for them to do it, but when the Moonies moved in, they made sure we could not do anything, you know. And they found reasons why we could not operate there, you know. So, but I think people are just a little bit more accepting now of that and realizing we're not maybe as big of a threat as they thought, you know, and that kind of thing. And I'm not sure, I think leader Christian, we just tried to make friends with Christian leaders and go to these interfaith things and this and that and invite them to our things, and things have slowly changed, not like quickly, but just step by step, year after year. And slowly, people are just a bit more accepting of our church, you know. So, I think that's a good thing. And how are we going to realize the kingdom of heaven, the mission, the kingdom of heaven? Getting back to that, I think, you know, it's maybe perhaps many churches have that kind of ideal, you know, of a kingdom, like the Jehovah's Witnesses talk about their kingdom. And even the radical Muslims have their kingdom, the caliphate, you know. Although maybe I don't buy into their thing exactly the way they're going about it, you know. But there's sort of, people have some kind of an ideal, you know. They want to see some better world, a peaceful world, an ideal world. And so I think this is a process. Personally, I think if we all could become like Jesus, you know, and have that level of understanding and heart and love for each other, I think maybe we could have a kingdom of heaven. But that means every person has to develop spiritually, you know. It's not just a force thing. You know, we can't force it. The communists try to create their paradise, but they couldn't do it, you know. And the North Korea, they're trying to create their paradise, but we know that it's really hell on earth over there, in my view, anyway. Except for a few of the nomenclatura, the top leaders over there, so I think it's a process of realization, in respect, people having to grow a lot spiritually. And I'm in the process myself. I'm sorry, maybe you thought I had reached the ultimate goal, but
I'm not too disappointed.
Yeah, I'm announcing to you tonight that I'm still on the path. So, anyway, diversity in the church. Well, we do have churches all over the world, so we could say that in that sense it's diverse. My church service here, we do have Hispanics, Asians, whites, and some occasional blacks. I wish we had more African Americans, and so we're and then I think the real key, in my view, to solving racial problems is interracial marriage, because I, when people ask me what am I, what nationality am I? Mm-hmm. Well, I'm 25% Estonian because my parents are Estonian. I'm 25% Canadian because I grew up there. I'm 25% American because I live here and I've been living here for a long time. And I'm 25% Japanese because my wife's Japanese. And you inherit something when you marry somebody from that person, you know. So I definitely feel like I'm a little bit Japanese, actually. And my kids obviously inherit mm-hmm. that, you know. And I have a son living in Japan right now. He's teaching English there. Mm-hmm. So we do have quite a lot of interracial marriages in our church. Mm-hmm. Not that everybody's interracially married. And the early Koreans, well, they just had to marry Koreans because the church was just in Korea. But especially in America, we have quite a lot of interracial marriages in the church. And I think this is going to be the answer to racial problems, myself. Because you have to start understanding and be sympathetic with another person's race when you marry the people from other races, you know. Mm. And so, I have a cousin, he's not a church member, but he married a black girl in Toronto, and he's actually a second cousin, but anyway, his parents and him are dealing with another race. These are white Estonians, like blonde hair and blue eyes, but their kids now don't have blonde hair and blue eyes, you know. Mm. But the grandparents love their kids, the parents love their kids, so... So all of, you know, here too, we have a brother from Argentina who married a sister from the Philippines, and we got a Mexican brother who's married a Malaysian sister, and on and on, you know. So you have to, when you marry across national lines and racial lines, you are... having to deal with those types of people and inheriting something from those people, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think, frankly, my wife's more religious than I am, just naturally. She grew up in a Christian family in Japan, you know. Mm-hmm. So she's, of course, it's only 1% Christian, but she's has a strong Christian spirit, mm-hmm. more than me. You know, mm-hmm. I grew up in the beer drinking Estonian family in Toronto.
Right.
So I don't naturally have as much of a Christian spirit as my wife does. You know? Mm-hmm. She's more religious than I am in many ways. So I inherit from her those things. You know, and that's a good thing for me. How I ended up in Kansas. Okay, my wife ended up here when she was, they were sending out missionaries. She came here on lottery. Mm-hmm. And I sort of ended up following her. So Kansas won us, mm-hmm. in a sense, right? Through this little lottery the church had where they're going to send the people, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's how we ended up in Burma, too. It was a little lottery. They said Myanmar. And I said, what's Myanmar? He said, Burma. And my heart sank because I had just watched a movie about this guy called Kunsa. It was on 60 Minutes, not mm-hmm. a movie, but it was a special. Mm-hmm. And it was about this drug lord and his 30,000-man drug army in Burma. And I had just watched it a few weeks earlier, and when I heard that
pretty
I'm going
alarmed.
To, yeah, when I'm going yeah. to Burma, I was, my heart sank. Oh my goodness, there's a 30,000-man drug army out in the jungles of Burma. That's a serious place to go, you know. But anyway, it turned out being a really good experience for me. And one thing I learned in Burma was that if you've got electricity, if you've got running water, if you've got some old car, and you've got a telephone that at least works some of the time, mm-hmm. you're already a rich person.
Mm-hmm.
Now in America, unless you're homeless, pretty sure you have those things. You got some old car, telephone, electricity, mm-hmm. and running water. Now I realize that most Americans are rich compared to a lot of people of this world, even though we like to say we're poor. Oh, I'm so poor. I couldn't buy that 65-inch television. Oh, I'm so poor, you know. Mm-hmm. But actually, we're rich. Americans are actually rich. It's just that we're comfortable and we always want to have more, you know. But in Burma, about 80 or 90% of the people when I was there were living in bamboo houses, you know. So you're in the city and you'd think that it's almost like a normal country in Yangon, which used to be called Rangoon, because they have normal looking houses and buildings and stuff and cars and things. But as soon as you start getting a little bit out of the city, you're in bamboo land, you know.
Mm.
Bamboo houses all over the place. The whole country is full of bamboo houses. Mm. And people, you know, with ox carts and all this kind of stuff. And it was like a whole different world, you know. And people living by the river in these bamboo houses and all this stuff. And there was a lot, so much of that, you know. That was a real eye-opening experience for me. But it was a very interesting experience for me, too, because we met the Prime Minister's wife and mm-hmm. had lunch with her, and I met the Prime Minister. And that little plate there on the wall, you see that kind of brownish little square rectangular plate way up there on the shelf there?
Yeah,
that was given to me by the Prime Minister's wife.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So that's pretty exciting. You got a gift from a Prime Minister's wife. But the next thing you know, they're under house arrest.
Well.
So that's what happens in Burma, you see? So when you get to the top of the mountain, the next step is you get pushed over the cliff. You know? So that seems to be the trend in Burma, you know? Whoever makes it to the top gets pushed over the cliff over there, you know? So so there were certain people who would not want to be too close to those top people.
Yeah.
Other people really wanted to be close to them, but other people said, no.
Comfortable distance.
Yeah, keep your distance, because you're in trouble if you get too close to those people. So and then we got to go to UN meetings and diplomatic meetings and stuff. And it was interesting for mm-hmm. me to do that, those kinds of things, you know. And to meet all kinds of people and meet ambassadors and this and that. And, you know, you don't get to do that in Kansas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Meet ambassadors or prime ministers, president's wives, and this mm-hmm. and that. Not a whole lot of that going on.
No, not frequently.
at least we have electricity 24 hours a day here.
Yeah.
In Burma, we had a 9-hour blackout every day. 9-hour blackout. Yeah, so it would get really hot, you know, and stuff. And but luckily, the electricity always came on from like, I think it was 11:30 at night till 5:30 in the morning. So mm-hmm. at least you could run your air conditioner, you know.
So you had at least something of a routine.
Was a routine there.
Yeah.
There was a routine there. And then, but there was one night when the electricity went off, and it was like 105 degrees, and I thought I'm going to go nuts.
Yeah.
You know, because I was pacing, and I felt like I'm getting a heat stroke or something, and I'm mm-hmm. going crazy, you know, but I survived it. But anyway, My experience being matched. Well, because I had been in a dating as a teenager,
mm-hmm.
and had sexual experiences as a teenager, and gave up on that, and was looking for God and meaning and value and religion. I actually started doing that when I was 18, maybe close to 19, when I kind of gave up on this thing. I was reading stuff that said that, religious people are celibate, some religious people. And before then, it's like you had to date. You had to conquer women. It's your mandate as a North American teenager to conquer women, mm-hmm. And if you're not doing that, there's something wrong with you. You are gay, or something is wrong with you if you are not conquering women, mm-hmm. So you must conquer women and brag about it to your friends, And then suddenly I realized you don't have to do that. You can, in a religious sense, you can be celibate, and it's okay to be celibate, And my girlfriend, when I told her, started talking about these things to my girlfriend, she started accusing me of being gay,
mm-hmm.
But that was not the case, But it was like a revelation to me that you didn't have to conquer women,
Mm-hmm.
So that was part of. I was kind of like ready to become a monk, really, when I joined Unification Church, and I just be in December of 1977, just before I met the Unification Church, just before I left Toronto, it was December the 23rd. I left Toronto. I had given my parents a statue of a monk, symbolizing that's me. This is my path now. And they were so upset. Why are you giving me this? You're crazy. They were so upset that I gave them this statue of a monk. They didn't like this concept at all.
Mm.
So when I joined the Unification Church, I didn't even know people got married. I thought we're just monks. We're just,
mm-hmm.
we don't need to have this anymore. We don't need to be dating. We don't need to be conquering women or, So then when I found out that people actually get matched in the church, and I got really excited. So.
Well, that's not so bad either.
Yeah. I like this. I want to do that. And so finally I got matched in 82. And I had, I was married in Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, And it was, for me, that was just perfectly fine. But for many people, that's not perfectly fine. And why could you let Reverend Moon choose your spouse? Or how could you have an arranged marriage? And why can't you just experiment and all this and that? But for me, I was just perfectly fine with that. I'd already gone through the dating thing.
Mm-hmm.
I'd already got to a point where now I want to be a monk. I want to be kind of like celibate. I want to find God. I want to do something religious in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I was only, like, just before I turned 19 when I was starting to think about these things,
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't difficult for me at all. I was excited. Oh, Reverend Ren's gonna find me a wife. Okay, and I had a dream that I got matched to the fattest girl in the church, 300-pound girl, and I didn't really know her, but I knew who she was. Because she was in the New York area, as I was at the time, and then of course I got matched to Mieke, who is not the 300-pound girl. Matter of fact, she is the exact opposite of a 300-pound girl. She's kind of thin and small and petite and everything. So I was right away attracted to her, and matter of fact, I felt like I was a young kid and a monk, and then suddenly I'm being thrust into the role of being a man. And this woman seemed much more elegant and mature than me, and yet she's accepting me.
Mm.
And so that was a very special time for me.
Did you meet prior to the ceremony?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, we had a matching thing, but mm-hmm. it was very quick. It was 1 week before the actual blessing, we call it, yeah. Mm-hmm. But we didn't start our family life, our sexual life, right away. We waited 3.5 years, which is, at that time, was pretty common in our church to wait from the matching to the actual time when you consummate your relationship. And why? Because of the fall of man, going back to the what we believe is a sexual sin of Adam and Eve. We are trying to offer something to God. Even now, we got a spouse, but we're really in an engagement period. You know, you might have gotten married, but you're not really married till you start your married life. And so we have a special ceremony for that too, to start the married life. You know, so that was not a big deal for me at all. Mm-hmm. Whereas, as maybe many people in America might think, it's pretty weird. But for me, it wasn't difficult. So that's my personal experience of kind of. You know, what do we do in the community? We try to do some interreligious work. Now we're involved with the interfaith, and we just. We're do little here. It's not that active. Our church is not that active. I don't get paid.
Right.
There are pastors in America who do get paid of the larger congregations, and they're much more active. I have to work every day, and so it's hard to keep actually work and run a church, you know, and not get paid for the church. Mm-hmm. So I'm basically busy 7 days a week, and I could do more, but after doing the rental things, by the time I'm pretty tired, actually.
Sure.
And it's a spiritually draining a little bit, this rental business for me sometimes, because you're dealing with, like...
Yeah, I was going to mention, I know that on the phone you had joked saying, or maybe not so much a joke saying, that, you know, your job sometimes... You know, it's kind of a... Yeah, so I was going to ask, is that something that you think about on a fairly regular basis, or that you've...
The contradiction of the...
Yeah.
Well, it's like, I wish I could be... had more strength spiritually and be more active spiritually, but I do have to put in a lot of hours for this rental business. And there's a lot... You know, people move a lot in America, and it's lower middle income, so there's certain troubles and... evictions involved, and people not paying the rent, and then people not taking that good care of the property, so you're having constantly to fix up these properties when people move out, so there's quite a lot of work involved, and so it's a bit difficult, frankly, and I wish I could be more active on the spiritual level, and but I because I'm in this small church here, and I'm not getting paid, and I have to get money from somewhere, you know. So that's a story here, and I hope that our church can grow here and step by step, and then we're also, you know, our members have to grow up and mature and become, you know, grow spiritually, you know, and then we can be more effective. As well, so that's a big issue. I feel is our own membership has to mature themselves, and then we have to raise up the second generation too, which we're in the process of trying to do. So we have a few second generation members who are starting to take more responsibility and stuff like that, because we're getting older, you know, and we, you know, I don't want to be like that 95-year-old Pope who's drooling and you know, remember that guy. Was it Pope John Paul, I think his name was, and I don't want to be that guy, so I sort of proclaimed recently that I would try to retire from my position in 2 years. I may not happen that quickly, but I'm hoping to find a second generation unificationist who would be willing to take up my spot. And they're, one of the goals of our church right now is by 2020 to have 50% of our leadership be under the age of 40.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if we can accomplish.
What does that look like right now?
Well, I'd say 10%
mm-hmm.
in nationwide. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we do have people who are, you know, younger, second generation mm-hmm. people in leadership positions. Our vice presidents, a couple of vice presidents are second generation people in their maybe late 20s. And then our district director is a second generation person, but he's about 40 years old. So yeah, there's it's slowly happening. I don't know about Kansas though. I think the younger people, they want to get some money, you know, mm. and we can't offer any money at this point for our local church here. Mm. You know, it's too small, really, yeah. to offer any substantial amount of money. So, but that would be one of my goals, definitely.
Mm.
So I can kind of be maybe more free to do stuff. I like to maybe take more visits to Burma, mm-hmm. and I went to Estonia this year, so I'd like to visit Estonia sometimes. One of my friends is Argentinian. I went to Argentina this year,
mm-hmm.
and you know, go up to Canada. I don't. My dad died, so I don't have that much reason to go to Canada now. But I'd like to. I was going 5 times a year to see my dad, actually, but I mm-hmm. think maybe get one trip in, and
mm-hmm.
I don't know. Want to go
something
see
about
my
being home?
Huh?
I said something about being home. Yeah, just good to go back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's my hometown, Toronto, and I kind of always wanted to. I had a goal that I really wanted to live with my parents before they died, but my father was just too difficult, you know,
mm-hmm.
and he wasn't really that open to it, you know, so. So I could never do that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel a little sad about that. I could never really move back to my hometown, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there's my friends and relatives there. And there's been some, Reverend Moon has been encouraging people to move back to their hometowns too and work with their relatives and friends, you know, and try to, you know, teach them about our church and stuff like that. So some people have done that and have been had some moderate success with that,
mm-hmm.
But I was never able to. My dad, he went through a lot in his life, and he had post-traumatic stress disorder, and he was very nervous, you know.
Yeah.
Little things would really set him off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't live with myself, or maybe I'm too sensitive, but I can't live with a person who's being set off by small things mm-hmm. all day long.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah, he just
had to be exhausting.
It's exhausting. So yeah. So every year we'd bring the whole gang up to Toronto. We'd bring the 4 kids, me and my wife, and we'd drive up to Toronto. Oh man, 20 hours up to Toronto, you know, and we'd try to do it in one day. And yeah, leave
ambitious.
At 4. Yeah, I know, and I did it usually in one day too. You know, we'd leave at 4 in the morning, and it's an hour later there. We'd get there about 1 in the
mm-hmm.
in the morning, kind of thing, and we'd say, okay, maybe we can move to Toronto, you know. But after 2 weeks of my dad, every mm-hmm. year the same thing. No, this is not happening. We're not moving to Toronto.
Get reminded every year.
Yeah, this guy's just too much for us, so we couldn't do it. So that's one of my regrets. Is mm-hmm. I actually. And Reverend Moon says you should try to have a goal of it, living 3 generations living in one house, you know. And there are some of our members who can have actually accomplished that. But myself, I could not accomplish the 3 generations living together.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things, you know, that I liked. I liked that idea.
Mm-hmm.
I used to not like that idea. Live with my parents? Are you kidding? And I don't want to live with my parents. That's crazy, you know. But the church gave me those ideals, you know, like, yeah, living with my parents, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like, yeah, that's really ideal. If you can get along with your parents and the kids and we're all one happy group there, you know. But that never happened in my case. So maybe that'll happen with one of my kids when they have kids and I'll mm-hmm. live with them. So we'll see how that turns out. So. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. I've blabbed on a long time here, and I and anyway, we have Sunday service here, and I maybe once a month I give Sunday service. I try to get other people to give the service, but I kind of try to organize all this stuff here, you know, the service, the PowerPoints, and we put it on PowerPoint, and I rehearse the band and stuff like that. It's not a professional band, but it's like
kids. Oh, you're being modest.
Well, I mean, this band is kids. They're kids. The one in New York was a bit more professional band, but this one is more like kids, and we just kind of sing these simple songs and stuff, and it's, you know, but I do that, and we try to keep our community going and stuff. So I think the ideals are really what keep it going. We actually believe that someday there will be a kingdom of heaven on the earth. But we're realizing that there's a lot involved to create that kingdom of heaven. It's not a magical wave your wand. We don't believe Jesus is coming back on the clouds, and we have to work at it. You know? And so we don't have any panacea or magic pill or anything to offer. We ourselves have to change, you know, and overcome our own fallen natures and sins and struggles and become better people and try to witness to others and teach our principles to others, and hopefully little by little, you know, we will have a better world. There are some countries that are doing very well in our church. You know, we're having breakthroughs in oddball places like Nepal and the Philippines and here and there. And you hear these stories of different breakthroughs happening. Of course, our church in Japan and Korea is fairly stable in those two countries. But it's a long way to go. And of course, if Rubber Moon is the Messiah, then these other religions, sooner or later, have to come to some realization about that, you know. But that's not going to happen quickly. If Rubber Moon is the Messiah, then that will take quite some time, you know. And he's passed away. He passed away 4 years ago, so this is going to take some time. Now Rubber Moon has got this, had this real incredible charismatic thing, and spiritually we feel he was much higher than us, but we have to be that example. But I feel like I'm way below that standard, you know. So I feel like, wow, we really got to take up the slack here, you know. But I'm over here and that guy's over there, you know. So that's it's gonna require each one of our members to grow up, you know. So
always work to be done.
There's a lot of work to be done. Yeah. So hopefully someday we'll all live in this peaceful, wonderful world that many people are dreaming of.
Well, thank you for sitting down to speak with me this evening.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry, I caught you off guard. I should have given a reminder.
Well, I'm sure glad you gave me the points, because I tried to go through your points here.
You did a great job.
And thank you. You did a great job preparing the points, because I might have gone all over the place, but that actually helped me a lot to kind of keep me at least somewhat on track.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm glad. Well, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for coming over.